to the Global Product Management Talk. This is Cindy F. Solomon, your host, with you today on Monday, June 10th, if you are in the United States. Very excited today. We have Terry Jones, who is the former CEO of Travelocity and the chairman of Kayak.com. I'm sure you have heard of both those properties, and we'll be speaking with him today about On Innovation, his new book, and how to reach through the bozone layer. Before we get there, you are listening to the Global Product Management Talk. We are a top 10 business podcast on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. We're on Twitter at PRODMGMTTALK. And if you are tweeting, please use the hashtag #PRODMGMTTALK. We are brought to you today by the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Management and Marketing. AIPMM membership benefits include regional conferences, the Career Center, peer forums, tools, templates, publications, and eligibility to enroll in the certification programs, including the Agile Certified Product Manager, Certified Product Manager, Certified Product Marketing Manager, Certified Brand Manager, and Certified Innovation Leader. These are programs allowing individual members to demonstrate their level of expertise and provide corporate members an assurance that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. Follow them on Twitter at AIPMM and on the web at www.aipmm.com. Look for their under webinars for their Friday webinar series. The Startup Product Movement, the Startup Product Summit, SF2, is happening on October 11th, 2013, the second summit in San Francisco. Register before June 24th for $400 off, and it goes up $100 after June 24th. Go to startupproduct.com, click on Summit, and join us at meetups in San Francisco at sfproducttalks.com. And I am traveling to Boston to launch the Startup Product Talks Boston Meetup. Look for it on meetup.com at Startup Product. Thanks to our broadcast sponsor at Sprintly. Sprint.ly. Don't ask how it's going. Watch how it's going with Sprint.ly. And thank you to BrainMates at BrainMates.com. Follow them for excellent information about product management. Okay. And we are here with Terry Jones, who is the former CEO of Travelocity. And I have a new tablet, which just gave out. I can't get onto the web to see my notes, but that's okay, because if you have been following and listening to me, I'm Cindy F. Solomon. You can follow me on Twitter at Cindy F. Solomon. And you know that product managers and what we talk about here weekly are product management, product excellence, innovation, process, knowledge, tools. Product managers have to be facile in a constantly changing business landscape, and I am constantly trying out new tools to stay on top of it and always have a worst-case scenario. So if we lose internet, we have Twitter. If we lose Twitter, we have the telephone, and you can listen to the podcast, which will be available following this, and follow the tweets. So, Terry, you're coming in from locally here on the West Coast?
Yeah, I live in Lake Tahoe in Incline Village up at the top of the lake. I've lived up here, gosh, about 9 years now. Many, many years living in Dallas because I worked for American Airlines for 20 years, but I escaped the heat, and now I'm in beautiful Lake Tahoe.
Nice. So, let me tell you, let's see, a few other things. No, you know what, Terry? Why don't you take it away? Give us some context of what is the bozone layer, Tell us about the book you wrote on innovation. And I know that all the listeners are very excited to hear from you. And there were a few questions that came in already asking about your success at Travelocity and Kayak.com.
Great. Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me here today. It's a pleasure to be on with you. You know, I left Travelocity almost 10 years ago, and one of the things I've been doing since then is public speaking, and I speak on innovation. And last year, I decided I wanted to take that message to more people, so I wrote a book that's called On Innovation, O-N, Innovation, and it's a little bit of an unusual book. It's 72 three-page chapters, so it's a book for the Twitter generation. It's a book you can pick up and put down and hopefully get some great ideas from. And I tried to put together a book that has lessons from Travelocity, from American Airlines, where I worked, from Kayak.com, where I've been chairman. I just retired as chairman because we sold the company to Priceline 2 weeks ago. And from the 10 different boards I've been on of startups. So it's a book that I think anyone in any company can use. It has a section about innovation in big companies, which is very different than innovation in startups. But the key messages that I have in the book relate to building culture and building teams. And I'm happy to go into detail about that, but let me throw it back to you for a minute and see if you want to go to those questions, or I can talk about some of those issues.
Well, the distinction between what it takes to arrive at product excellence in a startup versus in a big company is really what the startup product movement is about. So it's about cross-functional collaboration and a holistic view of the product, which is traditionally the perspective that product managers should have. And I would think that also product managers are middle management to your perspective. So we're looking up at innovation, and from where you're sitting, you're kind of looking down, or you know, you have the helicopter view of the organization.
Right. Well, and there's this barrier in between that I call the bozone layer, which is the impenetrable layer of management that stops good ideas from moving upward. And that's really because in so many corporations, there's either no reward or a small reward for success, but there's always punishment for failure. And so in building the right culture, if you want innovation to succeed, for leaders, it's about encouraging a culture of innovation. I say that innovation is like baseball. It's not like the Olympics. In the Olympics, you got 1 6-minute run down the mountain. You've trained for 15 years for that run, and you come in fourth. Well, you're out of the medals, and you're probably out of professional competition. If in baseball, if you fail 70% of the time, you're actually very good. You know, you're batting 300. And what leaders of both startups and particularly in larger companies have to realize is that you're going to have a lot of failures on the road to success. And what you have to learn how to do is kill the project and not the people. And big companies have a hard time doing that. But if you start doing that, and if you start as a leader reaching down through the bozone layer and finding those great gems of ideas that absolutely exist in your company, usually at the lowest level, at the person in customer service, at the person in the manufacturing line, those people know what you should be doing. If you take those ideas, put them in place, and trumpet their success, then you actually kill some projects without killing people, then you're going to see that bozone layer dissolve, and you're going to, as the leader, you're going to see innovation begin to flourish.
So by killing people, what you're saying is they play the blame game. So a project or a program didn't achieve what the business goals were, or didn't meet the KPIs, the key performance indicators. So instead of doing a retrospective to see what went wrong in the process and what all the contingencies were, you're saying they'll just fire the person who was in charge of this project or program?
Well, either fire them or, you know, they get shuffled off somewhere. And you know, they might be passed over the next time there's a promotion. They don't have to fire them, but it's pretty becomes pretty clear that, you know, this person made a mistake, right, and therefore, or didn't make a mistake, but they had a, at all, they had a project that didn't succeed, and they take the rap for it. As opposed to you saying, as you said, go back and figure out what went wrong, if you can, learn from it, and try again. You know, sports teams are a good analogy. They spend a tremendous amount of time watching game films of what went right and what went wrong in a game they lost. They don't do it to assess blame. They do it to improve their process going forward. And I think that's incredibly important in creating a culture where people want to innovate and where they will move forward.
Yes, and that's one of the things that we see also from the holistic point of view of following the product from inception to launch to retire is, gosh, who has time to do a retrospective? We're on to launching the next product or, you know, the next project. However, people who are project managers, they are charged with doing a retrospect. That's part of their measurements of success. But product managers, we don't have that in place. We're measured by how successful that product is out in the marketplace.
Well, that's right. And you know, you need to, the leaders above them need to take the time to say, hey, you know, this product wasn't all that successful in the marketplace. You know, what in the process was wrong? It may have been the concept of the product. It may have been the execution of the product. It might have been the marketing of the product. Let's figure it out. And you want to figure it out because maybe you can change it. You can pivot or correct. Or you have to say, hey, this was just a bad conceptualization of an idea, and, you know, we've got to move on. But it's important, you know, in one of the things I talk about in the culture is that there are a lot of naysayers in companies, and naysayers suck. You know, in the idea phase of a project, you've got to have people who are positive, who are the glass half full people, not the glass half empty people. Those are the people you want on your team so that you can generate good ideas. And, you know, they're not all going to be good. Some of them aren't going to work. I had to make a speech about innovation to the American Society of Quality Management recently, and I said, wow, this is going to be tough because quality people, unfortunately, have a role of many times saying no, you know, or saying wait, or saying, hey, we have to change this product before it goes out the door to get what you call, you know, an excellent product. And I thought for a long time how I wanted to address that, and what I said to them was, You do exactly the right thing, and you have developed a wonderful quality of culture in the United States, which didn't exist 30 years ago. But you can't do that during the ideation phase. You have to let the ideas flow and let people get started and build prototypes and do testing. And as you do that, then inject more and more quality into the process. If you inject it too early, you'll shut it down. Steve Jobs once said, I love to go to car shows and see the concept car, but I can never buy the darn thing. When the car comes out, it doesn't look anything like the concept because, you know, there wasn't that vision and strength to take the idea all the way through and actually manufacture it and put it into the marketplace.
I just want to do a shout-out to our tweeters and also thank them for reminding me that Terry will also be speaking at the Pipeline Conference Day 2, which is coming up on June 19th. Go to pipelineconference.com to register if you didn't attend Day 1, and there will be a re-airing of the presentation Terry did at the first one, as well as he'll be available live for Q&A. So thanks, Kaylee Kolditz at Demand Gen Kaylee for reminding me. Thanks, Pipeline Conference, for listening in. And shout out to Alicia Dixon, who's tweeting from Washington, D.C. So great. They're just underlying what you were saying about failure as a learning opportunity and punishment limits innovation. And you should...
Punishment limits a lot of things, right? But it certainly limits innovation. It's a real problem. So, you know, getting around that and as leaders really reaching down to the people who have those great ideas is critical in moving forward.
Yes, and that's a big thing in startups and in lean development. Fail quickly. So you can iterate and try again. But I think it's also expensive to fail quickly. If we could learn before, you know, do you think it's possible to learn without failing?
Well, sure, it's possible to learn without failing, and lots of learning, you know, that you do in school is about learning from others who have succeeded. But I think, you know, in the real world, in the marketplace today, you know, you may just show up with a hit on your hands, and that's great. But with all the work I've done with startups, you know, there's a lot of change that goes on from the initial concept to the success in the marketplace. And when we rolled out mobile for kayak.com, we really thought it would be about next flight out. You know, the meeting was over early, I get to go now. It would be about hotel tonight. I'm staying late and I need a room for tonight. So we thought it would be sort of an instant use product. It turns out that people actually are booking 2.5 weeks out and using the mobile product exactly like they use the browser-based product. So we had to modify that product based on the customer feedback very quickly, and now we have over 25 million people using the product. You know, our initial idea of a mobile product really wasn't what people were going to do, because we didn't think, oh, people are going to really be making long-term travel planning on a mobile device. But they do, and the devices have evolved to where they can. So I think you need that feedback. And, you know, today, if it's a web product, obviously everybody calls it beta. You get that feedback. But even in larger products, I think it's about prototyping. The 3D printer is allowing us to build models very quickly and test them with customers. I think prototyping and testing gets around a lot of those expensive failures because the processes today just cost less.
That's for sure. So going back to the issue you were talking about with what you thought people would be doing with mobile in developing the kayak.com mobile, didn't you have testing to validate what the original hypothesis was?
Well, that you know, that's exactly what happened. But today you can test so quickly by putting a product out into the customer's hands. If you have a product like Kayak, we had an initial thought about Kayak, the website, as well. It changed a lot over the years, and customers, we debated strongly about whether we should have Kayak, which has all these filters and the ability to really finely grain tune the product you want to look at, but it has a lot of knobs and dials on it, right? It's kind of a professional based product, and we've debated strongly about whether that's good or bad, and you know, we're just constantly iterating and testing. About 20% of what you see at Kayak every day is a test. So the great thing about the web today and about mobile is you can put out a product to 10-15% of your user base, let them test it for you, call it a beta or don't, and do ABCD testing in a live environment and learn right away. You know, I think the days of starting with a drawing, doing focus groups, spending a year, people just don't do that anymore. And customers are much more accepting of trying something out. In fact, many of them want to try things out and see how it works and participate in shaping the product themselves. Certainly, it doesn't work with an automobile or large industrial products necessarily, but even consumer products get pretty quickly tested and modified these days. So I think we've gone to a prototype and test culture more than the, you know, birth of an elephant, 3 years gestation period thing.
For sure. As a matter of fact, last week we had on one of the founders of UI, which is they use a webcam to watch users interacting with websites, and they also capture facial recognition emotions. It's really...
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's really smart. I mean, you know, years ago, when I was chief information officer at Sabre, the American Airlines division that automated travel agents, and we had 40,000 travel agents around the world with our computer systems. You know, in those days, we'd have a usability laboratory where we'd be behind one-way glass, and we'd have customers come in and test the prototypes and watch them. And it was always important to have the programmer there so they could actually see the face of the user struggling to use their product. Because that gets around the kind of denial you get as a product manager to come back to tell the programmer, well, you know, they really think your product is terrible. And they find all kinds of reasons to deny that. But you can't really deny what somebody's face looks like. So I think doing that with webcams is great. Now you can get all these online panels who will do that kind of testing. You know, it's focus group in the 21st century to use that kind of webcam. It's what Intuit did 20 years ago when they started making QuickBooks. They sent people into people's, you know, they sent their employees into people's homes to watch how people balanced their checkbook and then watched how they did it with their new products. And you've got to do that all the time. It's just today it's so much easier. And I think particularly the 3D printing innovation does that very well. And I talk about in the book on innovation, you know, how you can build those prototypes and do this kind of very quick testing. You know, the other thing I talk a lot about in the book is how to build the right kind of team for innovation and who should be on those teams. And it's in how you should organize. One of the things that we did at Travelocity, because it was a big idea inside of American Airlines, was I worked very hard to create a separate organizational structure where we separated Travelocity. So as opposed to having a product committee or a product team where people from marketing, sales, operations, IT, et cetera, all came together to try to do this, we actually moved everybody in a separate organization. I also moved that organization off the American Airlines campus to a separate building. And both those things had a lot to do with forming a culture around the product and pushing it forward at a speed that would have been very difficult to do inside a company as large as American.
Excellent.
We also did some other things with that, you know, and I cover that in a section called, you know, innovation in a large corporation. It's, you know, I worked very hard to bring in people from outside the company with different kinds of views, people who didn't have travel experience, people who were much younger than the people who were initially on the team, and people who were different than us. And, you know, I think that's very important to have kind of a team of rivals around innovation so that you get vigorous debate, because debate creates sparks, and sparks start fires, and then you get ideas. And I think that's extremely important. I also learned from watching Paul English, who's the chief technology officer at Kayak. He really works very, very hard at hiring the finest engineers he can find anywhere in the world. And he will literally get on a plane and go anywhere. If he hears about a great engineer working in the United Kingdom, he'll be there the next day to try to convince them to work for Kayak. And, you know, there's a saying in Silicon Valley that rock stars hang out with rock stars. And in watching that happen at Kayak, it's absolutely true. I mean, we took this company public with only 200 people, which is pretty incredible. Travelocity has something like 4,000. Now we have a different business model, but still part of that has to do with the quality of the people and how much more productive top players are than mediocre players. So we worked really hard in the startup mode to really get the finest people we could put together.
So here's a question that I have. In team and people and cross-functional collaboration is key to arriving at product excellence, according to the startup product movement. But if you're looking for the top people, and you're also looking for people from outside to get their perspective, how do you identify that perspective to put them on the team. If they're out, they're outside, they're not already perhaps operating as rock stars within this context of what the product is intentioned for.
Well, I think that's okay. You know, one of the people that we hired at Kayak was an Olympic medalist, you know, who'd moved into product management, but not in travel. And, you know, we looked at the kind of drive that that person had to win an Olympic medal and said, yeah, you know, that person has the drive it takes and will certainly be smart enough to adapt. We took people, the guy who did marketing at for Travelocity came, you know, from a totally different business, but was a great marketeer. And I said, you know, this person can shake up what we're doing here. I hired a lot of people like that. And I think if you look at somebody who's had a varied career, who's been successful, maybe even somebody who's been successful and had a failure because they learned from the failure, it's no different than somebody who says, well, I can't hire somebody from a liberal arts school because they don't have, you know, a specific advanced degree. Well, hopefully they've learned how to learn. And so I would rather have a team that can mix it up a little better. If you get a team of people who all know everything about the product and they're all specialists in your area, you're not going to get much lateral thinking. You may end up with the most highly optimized version of the thing you already have, but you may not end up with something that's radically different. And, you know, there's a thing called the Golden Rule of Innovation that came out of some Harvard research. It says most companies spend 70% of their research budget on adjacent, just kind of tweaking their current product, moving it forward, and maybe 20% on adjacencies, on things that are pretty close. And only 10% of the research budget is on really radical products. But if you look at the future revenue of those companies, 70% of their future revenue will come from those radical 10% of their projects. So you got to take some risks and you got to do some radical things. You can't spend all your money on it. And that may be where you want this team of mixed up, you know, mixing different kinds of folks on a team of rivals to get some really radical thinking.
Excellent. Excellent. So, by the way, you are listening to the Global Product Management Talk. This is Cindy F. Solomon, your host. I'm speaking with Terry Jones, who is the former CEO of Travelocity and chairman of Kayak.com, which was just bought. He also is the author of On Innovation, the book, which you can get at www.jonesoninnovation.com. We are broadcasting live from Studio 132 in the Oakland Hills of California with BZ Lewis, our six-time Emmy-winning sound engineer and excellent musician. Also, if you haven't yet registered for the online conference for innovative product development, Pipeline 2013, a mini conference day two is coming up on June 19th. Go right now to pipelineconference.com to register. You'll be able to access all the resources and information available there through August. But on June 19th, Terry Jones will also be available for a live Q&A with Dr. Robert Cooper. Okay, and by the way, follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK to get updates of upcoming podcasts and archives of over 80 episodes. Okay, let's see, just checking the tweets. And we're talking about innovation. So tell me more about what the bozone layer and what that means. I haven't used this. I haven't seen this term before, Terry.
Well, it kind of came from a Gary Larson cartoon I saw years ago. You remember The Far Side? And he had this sort of ring bozone, the clown people around the world, like an ozone layer. And I thought, boy, that's like what happens in big companies where, you know, there's really no incentive for new ideas because nobody gets rewarded for them, or they'll get a tiny reward if they do something right, but as we talked earlier, get punished when it fails. And I saw this change, actually, at American Airlines. We brought in an idea program from GE, and the way that program worked was pretty interesting. Let me give you an example. So there was a guy in our maintenance department at American who had the concept of, he was thinking about all these regional jets we have, and how when you got on the regional jet, you had to walk outside. You couldn't use a jet bridge, and you'd walk through the rain. And he said, there's got to be a way to connect one of those jet bridges, the big walkway that connects to the airplane, to these small jets. And he invented a little kind of a walk-the-plank thing that you probably have seen if you go on a regional jet, that they stick on the end of a jet bridge so that you don't have to go outside in the rain and you don't have to walk up the stairs. And he submitted that idea to the maintenance department, and they rejected it. They said, we're going to have to buy more jet bridges, and it's expensive, and we're out here on the tarmac, so why can't everybody else be? It's not a big deal. Then we put in this new idea program, and that program required that every idea that was submitted by employees was reviewed by somebody from the affected department, but also two people from other departments. Well, as soon as that idea was reviewed by the people from marketing and the people from operations, they said, this is a terrific idea. You know, people would like flying on regional jets, and therefore they approve the idea. So you get around those people who say, well, we've always done it this way, or we've never done it that way. And those are the people who kind of create the boson layer that stop good ideas from moving upward. Now, the other thing we did was that if you submitted an idea like that one, you could be rewarded as an individual based on either the amount of revenue the idea created or the amount of savings that it created. And the affected department was required to put that revenue in their budget or take that money that was saved out of their budget. And so the rewards were substantial for the people getting ideas, which means they generated more of them. But more importantly, I think, the system of reviewing ideas. And so I think the generality is, try to get your idea looked at by as many people as possible, and particularly not people, you know, directly in your chain of command who may have, refused it before. If you can have some system in the company that gets wide review, you have a better chance of success of your new idea, and you can break through that boson layer.
Excellent. So boson coming from bozo.
Coming from bozo. Yes. So a layer of bozos is what we're talking about. And I think you're laughing because you know that it exists in all kinds of companies. So, you know, we talk about that as a way to really facilitate ideas, because ideas are just little sparks, right? They're a flame, and we're talking about them. We're going around the table, and we're all excited, and somebody says, well, let me play devil's advocate here for just a moment. And, you know, poof, the candle goes out. The spark is gone. So you need to have a way to widely circulate those ideas because they may sound crazy. You know, when they started, we met the Swifter mop that has been such a success. Hey, that was a diaper on a stick, right? I mean, the Procter & Gamble guys, were looking at, they make cleaning products, they make diapers, they make tampons, and they kind of looked at that and they said, well, what if we combine these and put them on a stick with some cleaning fluid? How would that work? That's a pretty screwy idea, and I think it's a $1 billion business for them now. So, the first reaction was probably to laugh as you did, a diaper on a stick. That's a pretty crazy idea. But, you know, everybody knows the story of the guy who invented the Post-it note and how long that took and how many people he had to talk to before someone said, boy, that's a pretty good idea to have a glue that doesn't stick all the time, to put things on and take them off. That takes a lot of courage, but it also, takes people listening. And my experience is, as I said earlier, the best ideas in companies come from the people working on the line. We had a concept of paging people when their flights were late. It doesn't sound like much now, but in 1996, nobody had ever done it. That came from a customer service agent who said, I'm answering the phone all day long for people who want to know if their flight's on time. In those days, that was the only way you could find out. Nobody called you very often. So we started paging people. It took off like crazy. And we built a prototype first. Another pricing analyst, an engineer, said, why don't we send out emails every time the fare changes? So if you've been searching for a fare to Boston, where you're going, we can email you to tell you, hey, the price went down. It's a good time to buy. Nobody had ever done that before. I got those ideas as a leader by holding meetings with lots and lots of employees and soliciting ideas, because it is the people doing the work who really can have the best ideas on what's going forward. And, of course, your customers can too. And today, you know, I encourage people to put sensors and sentries in their systems to listen to customer feedback, because we don't meet the customer face-to-face the way we used to. You know, Kayak.com, Travelocity, we have millions of customers. We never meet them. So at Kayak, for example, we don't have a traditional customer service phone bank. We're a search company. But all the emails that come in from customers actually go to engineers. They don't go to customer service. There is no customer service function. And the engineers have to answer customer emails. And you might say, well, that's pretty expensive. Well, in the end, it's not, because the engineers will directly go and fix the defects that the customers are complaining about, or hear about a new customer idea and discuss it with other engineers, and we get ideas that can move us forward. So listening to your employees and listening to customers is really a terrific way to push yourself forward.
Wow, that's excellent. You talk about so many things that are relevant to what we talk about here on a regular basis. And one of the things that you're talking about is culture, organizational culture, and actually putting in, you know, enabling how to confront the fear of failure and enabling people to speak up and not be shut down for coming up with suggestions that might be outside of what the current process is. And the other thing I also want to underline of having engineers answer customer complaints, that's essentially tech support, is it not?
Well, in a way it is, but usually tech support is off in customer service somewhere. These are the actual engineers doing the work. You know, these are people who spend their whole day, you know, writing our new software. So it's a little more than that. Because tech support is usually second-level support, you know, people who do support all day, but they're second or third level. These are actually the, you know, every programmer at Kayak. We also have a thing called the Red Phone. So we do have a phone at Kayak. It only goes off maybe once a day. We put the phone number up on Kayak for maybe 10 minutes, and the phone goes off, and some, you know, an engineer has to answer it, and then they get to move the phone to somebody else. And when everybody's involved in customer service, you learn so much. I actually, my cell phone rang the other day. I was out on a hike up here in the mountains in Tahoe, and it was a customer of Kayak. And he was frustrated by Kayak, and he called one of our numbers, because we do now have a phone bank for certain kinds of bookings, and didn't like the service he got. He Googled Kayak.com, looked at the board of directors, found the chairman, Googled me, got to my website, found my phone number, and called me up. And so I sat down on a boulder and spent a half an hour fixing his problem, because every customer is important, and I learned something from it. So I think, you know, that kind of culture of not insulating people, of letting everybody talk to customers at every level, is extremely important. You know, I saw something recently. I made a speech on innovation to a very large Fortune 500 company. We talked to 200 people. They were all excited about going off, and we taught them a lot of processes to innovate. And then the chairman got up and said, well, you know, this is all good, but I don't want you running around with your hair on fire. I only want you to innovate about these two things. And you could feel the air just go out of the room, right? I got his idea. He didn't want everybody running around with their hair on fire, but he should have let them do that for a few days. You know, it's like letting the kid stomp around the mud puddle. So build some excitement, you know, and then channel it. But he was right back into the corporate, this is what we're going to work on, and think about that thing that we've done so many times, and these other things, well, we've never done them that way. Poof, innovation gone, right? It is about culture.
It's about culture, and it's about leadership getting out of the way and letting people take ownership about the ideas and about new possibility.
Yeah, I think getting out of the way is really important. And as I said earlier, one of the things that I did to do that at Travelocity was I got the whole company out of the way. We picked up and moved to a different building. We created a different culture. We had our funding done at a very high level so that other departments couldn't steal our money because we were losing money in the beginning. Location, organizational structure, funding, and team were critical for our success. Now, eventually we spun the company out and took it public. And later they bought it back. But, you know, separating it, they did the same thing at Recreational Equipment. They did the same thing at Best Buy with their internet efforts. And it was interesting in talking to the leader at REI. She said, you know, we had a separate internet division for a long time. But when the internet grew up, we turned the organization chart on its side and poured the internet in. And by that she meant we dissolved the division. We didn't need it anymore. Everybody was responsible for that. But we had to put it in the greenhouse first and protect it so that it could grow. Very insightful. Because ideas are fragile little seeds that need to be protected, you know, so they can grow. Because the culture of the organization overall sometimes can kill new ideas. So it's up to the leadership to protect them until they get big enough, right, that they can be successful.
Excellent. So we have a couple of questions coming in from Alicia Dixon. Would like to know, hold on a second, where did it go? Here it is. Could you give an example of the sensors, as you mentioned, to capture feedback?
Sure. I mean, I think there are a couple things that people are doing. Obviously, reading emails is one. Another thing we did at Travelocity, we had a British phone booth in the hall, and if you picked up that phone, you could listen to customer service. And it was just a symbol to remind everybody that every single person at Travelocity was required to dial in and listen to 2 customer calls a month. And then at staff meeting, discussed 2 things. First of all, how can we fix the company so people don't have to call with that particular question? What's wrong with the website or the service that's causing people to call? And 2, what did we learn? You know, did you learn something new? Is there something we can improve? Is there a new idea that came because of those customer issues that could move the company forward? That involved everybody. So that's a kind of sensor. Having everybody read the emails is a kind of sensor. Another thing companies are doing is having websites where customers can put up product uses, because people don't always use the product the way you think they might. Glad has 1,001 uses for Glad Wrap. And I looked at it the other day, and people are using it. Instead of taking the light fixtures down when you paint, you just wrap Glad Wrap around the light fixture and paint right by it. You know, I would never have thought of that. At WD-40, they learned that people in Florida were putting WD-40 on their cars in the spring so that all the bugs in the spring wouldn't stick to the front of their car, because I've lived down there, and if you get your car covered with bugs, it can wreck your paint. Well, that was pretty important for WD-40, because if you spray it on your car, you use a lot of their product, right? And they learned that from a customer. So it's about having your eyes wide open as opposed to having your eyes wide shut. Many companies, I think, the people in the company don't use the product or don't use it the way the customer does. I see this in hotels all the time. I'm on the road 150 days a year. I see it when I make presentations. I mean, even today, many times I'll walk in and make a presentation, and I'll have to find a book or something else to put under the projector so that it can reach high enough to get to the screen. Well, what's wrong with those companies? It's been going on for 10 years, right? I used to put the Yellow Pages under there, but I can't find the Yellow Pages anymore. They've even gone out of business. So why can't they fix their own product? Well, I don't think they use their own product. You know, the ones in their office are probably bolted to the ceiling, or they have an army of technicians, you know, so when somebody uses the product, it's perfect. You don't want that, right? You want to go out and use the product like everybody else And that's another kind of sensor, too. So the more sensors you can put in, and today on the web, of course, we have all this wonderful analytics software that can tell us what to do. And what the customers are doing. Recently, I was at one of the companies where I'm on the board, and the head of marketing said, I want to talk to you about social media. And I said, well, we're not going to talk about that. He said, well, that's what I want to talk about. And I said, sorry, I'm your board member, and I'm going to pick. You can't do social media. And he was, looked at me incredulous. I mean, social media is the hot new thing. And I said, no, you don't get it. Your website sucks. Your conversion rate is 1% of sales, right? And if you do social media, everyone will know you suck. So before you do that, go fix your website, get it running right, and then go out and popularize yourself. But, he wanted to do the shiny new thing. And he wasn't looking at the data that he already had that said, hey, my basic business isn't working well enough to go promote it. He wasn't looking at the sensors he already had. And that's why if you listen to customer feedback, they will tell you what's wrong. And if you take that feedback and do something with it. I was walking down the manufacturing line at Cessna Aircraft recently, and I saw all these look like memos posted at every workstation. Well, they weren't memos. They were emails from customers. One said, the seats in my aircraft are fantastic. They're beautifully made. I really like them. Great job. Another one said, the door on my airplane always whistles. Why can't you make a door that shuts properly? Taking that customer feedback and giving it to the engineers, to the people on the line, what a great idea. So have the sensors and then use the data in a way that can push you forward.
Excellent. So I wonder if you could speak to a product management question. Juan in San Francisco Bay wants to know, in your ideal world, do you have a right proportion between product and engineering in an organization? And what would be the number one contribution that you're expecting from product managers?
Well, I think obviously you almost always have a lot more engineers than you have product managers. So, sometimes you see, a 1-to-1 ratio. But I think today, with the kind of prototyping tools that are available, I'm going to spend the weekend with a company called iRise, where I'm on the advisory board, where they have just amazing prototyping tools, and there are a lot of those tools out today. I think you certainly can have more engineering types than you need product. Marketing or product management types, but I think, you used the word holistic before, and I think that's what I would look for in the product management team is, or the product management leader, is to really look at all the pieces of the development, from how we're going to build the product to how we're going to support the product to how the marketing department is going to roll that product out to its life cycle, as you suggest, to how it gets priced. How we account for it, do we have the right billing systems? I mean, there's so many pieces that are involved. And getting that cross-functional coordination between the departments, trying to be the orchestra leader to really get this thing to work and come out in a coordinated way. And, maybe to build a prototype and test it first so that you can get around the people who say it won't work or the naysayers that say, oh, we can't afford that. That's part of product management too. So I think the product manager is the orchestra leader who could bring this all together. And in an innovation team, it may just be more of the lead player in a jazz band, because innovation sometimes is more like jazz and people riffing together than it is a symphony. But in the end, you've got to make beautiful music that people want to listen to and products that people want to buy. And that means having all the departments working together to get it out the door.
Excellent. Excellent. That's exactly what the, quote, startup product movement is about, working holistically.
Okay.
It's not about titles. It's about a focus on product excellence, which everyone has a different perspective of what that means. But if the culture enables people looking for what's not working in order to be able to voice what needs to be fixed, and including the customers. I also would include the non-customers and the competitors' customers. They certainly will know what's not working with your product.
Oh, absolutely. You know, competitive intelligence, extremely important, understanding, you know, where, and understanding focus, you know, where I don't want to be. Where I'm going to let somebody else innovate because, you know, we don't want to do it. And remembering that innovation looks different because of where you sit. I was at a asked to speak on innovation to a 120-year-old insurance company. And I thought, wow, what can I teach this company? I mean, they've managed to stay alive for 120 years, which is, you know, 80 years longer than almost any other company stays alive. And I was talking to someone in the reception before the meeting, and she said, well, I've done this innovative thing. I said, really, what was that? And she said, I've unlocked our PDF form so that our customers can actually type on the PDF form in their computer. They don't have to print it out and write it by hand because nobody has typewriters anymore. And I went, wow, that's really great. Now, I didn't point out to her that idea is so old that the IRS did it like 8 years ago, right? But in her company, that was innovation. So that was cool. That was okay with me. You know, she actually saw a customer need that they hadn't put in place, and she did it, and she got it done. And okay, you know, that, you know, it depends on which end of the binoculars you're looking through, and that's cool. Anything that moves your company forward, that makes it better for customers, is innovation to me. Because remember, you know, the definition I like is that creativity is thinking up new things, but innovation is doing new things. It's putting an idea to work. I have 4 patents on the wall here in my office, and I'm very proud of them. But they're only creative ideas. They are not innovations, because the company I worked for at the time never reduced them to a product. So remember, you got to ship. You got to get this thing out the door. Warren Bennis called the making of Snow White, the movie, a dream with a deadline. And that's what a product is. We go back to product management. It's taking that dream and giving it a deadline and getting it out the door and shipping it to real customers and creating revenue. And we can't ever lose sight of that. Sometimes the projects get so big and so complicated, you know, it sounds like a Pentagon project that keeps the price schemes going up and they never ship the new systems. It's about putting it in the customer's hands and getting it to them and earning some money, and that's in the end what innovation, you know, is for.
Oh, I love that. That product management is about dreams with deadlines. That is brilliant.
Well, that's in you know, again, that's in the book on innovation, and I hope your audience can take a look at it. It's available, as you said, at jonesoninnovation.com. It's available on amazon.com. And, you know, talking about innovation, this book is kind of innovative. I told you about how, you know, it's 72 three-page chapters. But here's another piece of innovation. When I wrote this book, I talked to several, you know, New York publishers, and they all wanted a year to produce the book. And I went, a year? Wow, that's a long time. And I said, well, will you promote the book? And they said, oh, yeah, we'll give you a great person to market the book. And I said, well, how much marketing money will you put in the contract? And they said, well, none, actually. So I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I need you guys. And I published this book through CreateSpace, which is a division of Amazon. I did it in 6 weeks. In 6 weeks, they did the layout. We did the cover. And when you order the book is printed. It's printed on demand. There's no inventory. So to me, that's 21st century innovation. And, of course, a large percentage of the books are electronic books anyway. But, you know, for me to hear about a process in the 21st century that takes a year, I'm like, whoa, this is 19th century stuff, you know, and I'm a 21st century person. So sometimes in innovation, and the cool thing today is that we can do innovation of crowds. We can get people to help us, and we don't have to do everything ourselves. We can reach out to all kinds of other people with ideas and services, so that, you know, I don't have to do it all myself. There are all kinds of places where I can get help to move my product forward quickly, and that's, you know, one of the things people are doing with innovation of crowds, where They actually say, hey, we have these resources, and we're looking to invent a product in this area. Can you help me? And they get people from outside the company who have terrific ideas. You know, you don't have, your company doesn't have a lock on all the best ideas. Today, it's easy to reach out through the web, get people to help.
Oh, gosh. Terry, I was jumping up and down when you were talking about how you published your book, and it's it gets published on demand, and you're actually what we call dog fooding. You're talking the walk. You're walking the talk. You're not only talking about innovation, you're demonstrating it in everything that you do. And that is so exciting and such a model, as well as you are a hands-on product person, which is rare to see at the top echelons of big organizations. So,
well, I've gotten in trouble for that more than once. You know, when I was leading Travelocity, we had, and I'm sure many of your listeners have, a fairly large product process that said, okay, how do you get on the list of up new products, and are you creating revenue? Are you improving customer service? Are you reducing costs? And, you know, one to N ranking, all that stuff. But I kept tinkering with that because I had all these new ideas. And finally, my team said, cut that out. You know, you're screwing up the process that you make us follow. And they were right. So what I did instead was we broke products up. We had big products that took a long time, and they were on one list. And, of course, a bigger product isn't necessarily a better product. It's just bigger. Customers don't really care how much effort you put into it. And then we had products that took less than 6 weeks to get in the market, and we had a long list of those. When we had a team that worked on that, got them out quickly. And then I had three guys that worked directly for me just taking my ideas and reducing them to prototypes. And we prototyped every one, and some were big failures and some were great successes. But that allowed me as a leader to kind of use my product management skills and my innovation skills, but not goof up the rest of the company where we were rolling out products. And everybody could do these prototypes. You know, we'd evaluate them and try them all the time because customers don't care how much work it takes. They just care what it does for them. Customers care about solutions. They don't care about your effort. So I still do that. I love doing prototypes. I love giving ideas to the guys at Kayak. It's very rewarding.
Excellent. It's unfortunate we're coming to the end of the hour, Terry. We could talk for another hour about these product-centric issues. I'm so glad that you are speaking again at the Pipeline Online Conference for Innovative Product Development, as well as your previous talks are available there. So I want to give another plug for people to register for the June 19th Day 2 mini conference at pipelineconference.com or go to sfproducttalks.com and you can see the information there, as well as upcoming digital events, AIPMM webinars, future speakers, and other great meetups and events happening in not only the San Francisco Bay Area, but also now in the Boston Innovation District area. Thank you so much, Terry Jones, for joining us today on the Global Product Management Talk. This episode will be available on iTunes as well as on blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. Please follow us there. It's also syndicated on Stitcher. We have an Android mobile app, PRODMGMTTALK. Just look for it in the Google Play Store, and it is available on every podcast application that you can find. So thank you so much, Terry, for calling in.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, again, the talk on innovation goes on at the Pipeline Conference and in the book, so on innovation. I'll keep innovating together, and thanks again.
Yeah, and let's definitely do it again. But it just occurred to me, how can you get a signed copy of the book?
Well, I guess people, if they want, that's a tough thing to do. I don't really know how to do that. If they If they come to jonesoninnovation.com, there's a contact form, and they can send me a note. And what I've done for ebooks is to actually sign a PDF copy and send it along if they buy one. So they can just use the contact form on jonesoninnovation.com, and I'd be happy to do that. But otherwise, that's the disadvantage of print on demand. I don't sit at the Amazon factory, so I can't sign them up there.
But it occurred to me that people could get their book and then come to where you are speaking, which they can find out by going to your website at tbjones.com and bring that printed book for you to sign in person.
It still is a paper world, so yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
That's great. Thanks again for joining us, Terry Jones. Thank you to the Pipeline Conference and PlanView for putting it on. Thanks to the Startup Product Talks community and meetups. This is Cindy F. Solomon telling you have a great week. By the way, I'll be driving cross-country in the next couple of weeks. So shoot me a tweet at Cindy F. Solomon if I should come by if you want to meet. I'll be in New York and Boston and Chicago and places on the way. So thanks again. Have a great week, and we will see you online and at Meetup. Bye, Terry.
Bye-bye now.